Today I want to talk about home buying, what that process looks like, and what banks are looking for. When you're purchasing a home, it's one of the single greatest forms of debt that a person or family will ever have. It requires some thought, research, and planning. But before you start looking at what I call the eye candy, it's recommended that you know your numbers. This is a critical step that many people skip, and they get excited about purchasing a home only to be let down emotionally. And I say this because if you find a property before knowing your numbers, you may not be able to purchase that house. And then the search itself changes, the criteria changes, and emotionally, you may be let down from wanting something but not being able to attain it. So once you know your numbers, you can then go confidently out into the marketplace and have a pre-approval letter in hand. This is exactly what I do. Day in and day out, my specialty is starting the borrower on the right path to home ownership. When you have this pre-approval letter, it informs agents and sellers that you can close on your home loan financing. After all, if we're the hinge that closes your escrow, we want to make sure that we can close efficiently and successfully. At the very end of the transaction, the end result will be the keys to your new home. The home buying process can be broken down into several sections, but I'll go through this pretty quickly. Number one, you would always want to start with a pre-approval for financing. Once that's completed, you want to talk to a real estate agent. You want to meet with them to complete a needs analysis. Find out what the room count is, square footage of the house, location, amenities, what the schools are in that area. What are the things that really are hot buttons for you? Perhaps you want a pool. Perhaps you want a house with a view. Or maybe something else, perhaps something close to family. All of these criteria can all be worked out once you get your pre-approval in hand, you sit down and talk with a real estate agent. Once you find that perfect house, you make an offer, and your offer gets accepted, now we start something called escrow. In California, we have escrow. Escrow is a non-interested third party that holds all of the funds that are necessary in a transaction, but they also fulfill the terms and conditions written out in your contract. And that escrow process typically takes between 30 and 45 days. And this is set typically by the contract that's agreed upon. Once you get your offer accepted, you start escrow, you're going to meet with the lender again, or at least have a conversation and go through the updated application. Once your pre-approval is completed, the lender should have your tax returns, your bank statements, your pay stubs, your asset validation, and any other information regarding your employment or questions that may come up about your qualifications. But it is not finalized yet. So now we're going to add in the application, the address of the property, the purchase price, the final terms, whether you're doing FHA, VA, USDA, or conventional financing, how much money is down that you're putting down, whether it be 3%, 3.5%, 5%, 20%, 50%, all of that is determined at this point. And it's finalized, meaning we're getting a number that will sit well with your overall qualifications. We then take that information, we submit it to underwriting. Once the underwriting department reviews that loan fits all the criteria for the loan that you were pre-qualified for, then we go ahead and move to the next phase, which is securing the loan. And that means that we're going to take the loan and actually securitize this. And we do that through clear to close. And all the while this is happening, you have other people involved. This includes home inspectors, potentially a termite inspector, perhaps a roof inspection, a septic tank if it applies, HVAC inspections, and also the most important piece for a lender, the appraisal. The appraiser is the eyes and the ears for the lender. They will take the time to go into more depth for the bank with regards to pictures, square footage, comparable sales, market time, any concessions may be paid for by the seller, all the things that are necessary to be the eyes and the ears for the bank. It's important to note that an appraisal can sometimes be challenged whether the value is valid or whether it comes in low, or if there's items that the bank wants more information for, so they may order a second inspection or re-inspection for review purposes. Once this is completed and we have our final formal loan approval, we want to fulfill the conditions that are requested. These may be smaller items. Perhaps there's an odd deposit. Maybe there's income that you're not using or income that you have that we didn't recognize in the pre-qualification process we need to address. And then if there's any other things, perhaps you have a non-purchasing spouse, this person is married to you, but they're not going on the loan, but they're rather going on title only. Perhaps you have a trust that you'd like to put the loan into. These are all types of things that happen during this formal final loan approval. Once all the conditions are cleared, we're given something called a CTC, or clear to close. This is an exciting part for the loan because it's typically in the last third of the loan process, and your loan documents would then be shipped to the escrow officer, and the escrow officer would then prepare the loan documents for a notary. The notary would then sign these loan documents with you. You'd be given your final numbers. Those final numbers would be the cash to close minus any prepaid items, which include your expenses you paid for your appraisal, your earnest money deposit, and any other inspections that were noted in your contract. Then we start preparing the file for closing. This is where your original loan documents are sent over to our funding department. The funding department then reviews these items for compliance and preparation for funding your loan. When your loan funds, it's really the celebration time. It means the bank has officially wired the full amount of the borrowed loan to the escrow company. The title company, in association with the escrow company, will receipt these funds in. They will then release the file for recording. Now, recording is where the keys come into your hand. This is the official transfer of title from the previous owner's name into your name. And this is where we all get to celebrate. And finally, your real estate professional gets to give you the keys. And this is really the milestone everybody is looking for. I want to spend some time now talking about loan types. There are basically two types of loan in the marketplace. One is conventional loans, and two, government-insured loans. This includes FHA, VA, and USDA. Conventional loans are based off of a term used in mortgage finance to refer to loans that are backed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. These loans offer options with as little as 3% down, can go to a much higher loan limit. It is a higher loan limit than FHA typically, and is based off the county that you're in. Currently, the maximum loan for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in Kern County, California, is $453,100. In our marketplace, that's quite a bit of house. Conventional underwriting guidelines are different from government insured. For the most part, they're a bit more strict in underwriting requirements, but they offer options for lender-paid mortgage insurance and the ability to purchase multiple homes. Conventional loans are a better choice if you can put 20% or greater down as a down payment. There's no requirement for mortgage insurance if you do so. You want to think of mortgage insurance like you would gap insurance on a car. If you were to default on your payments, the bank would then foreclose on the home, but would have insurance to protect the lender from losing any funds. Conventional financing is best suited for buyers who are typically able to put 3 to 20% or more down and have a FICO score above 680. Now let's go into government-insured loans, and we'll start with FHA. FHA is short for Federal Housing Administration, is synonymous with HUD, or Housing Urban Development. It was established in 1934 under Franklin Delano Roosevelt's reinvestment back into the United States under the New Deal. And one of the things that he did was he created opportunities for people coming back from war to house themselves. And depending on where you're at in the country, you may have noticed there are specific parts of town that have very similar looking homes. We call these homes kind of cookie cutter. They were typically minimally square footage, maybe 800 to maybe 1100 square feet, but they were all in a row and they were all very similar. They all typically had a small front yard and a backyard, but they were homes that were really designed to create neighborhoods. And that's really the result of FHA's establishment. Now, FHA today, it's not a lender. They just set underwriting guidelines for lenders, and they use banks to facilitate their insured program. And we close under these guidelines set by FHA. If you were to foreclose, FHA would pay out mortgage insurance to protect the bank. And they, again, are not a lender. FHA is nothing more than an insurer, but they have specific guidelines for us to be able to get that insurance. Let's move on to VA. VA is the Veterans Administration. It actually is one of my favorite loans. And we do actually specialize in this loan. And the reason why I say specialize is because not everyone is equipped to do a VA loan. We at Sierra Pacific Mortgage, our parent company, are direct endorsement lenders with VA, and we love our veterans. We appreciate their service to our country, but we also have an opportunity to serve them in a way that is unparalleled for other loans. So the first thing I want to bring up about VA loans is it's 100% financing. You can always put a down payment, but with 100% financing, you don't have a down payment requirement, and there's no monthly mortgage insurance. They do have something called a VA funding fee, but VA funding fee is only for a reserve account that's set up by the VA in order to protect the VA in case of any type of foreclosure activity as well. Now, the same holds true with VA as FHA. VA is not the lender, they are an insurer. And because of that, if we meet all the requirements and underwrite to their guidelines, if there is a situation where the veteran goes into foreclosure, VA will pay out a loss through their guarantee. Now we move on to USDA. USDA is a rural housing program designed for those purchasing in areas that are designated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It does offer up to 100% financing, and it is actually completed in such a way that the loan is funded and underwritten to the standards of USDA and is insured by USDA directly. Now, let's move on to the application itself. Here are things that you're going to need to know. When you go to an application or you're taking an application even online, you're going to need to prepare some very important financial documents. Number one, if you work for a company and are W-2'd, you're going to need to provide the last 30 days worth of pay stubs. If you're paid biweekly, then we'll need 3. If you're paid semi-monthly, we'll need 2. The bank is going to be looking for your payment frequency, how consistent your income is, and your year-to-date in order to calculate an income. The second thing they're going to be looking for is your tax returns. If you are not self-employed, then providing W-2s and your tax return, federal 1040, for the last 2 filed tax years will be necessary. If you are self-employed, we'll need to have the last 2 years federal tax returns, all schedules, including your Schedule C, or if you're incorporated, other forms like the 1120 or 1120S. If you have income that derives itself from being an independent contract, then you're going to file a Schedule C and you receive a Form 1099, which means they don't take any taxes out. It's your responsibility as a consumer to pay those taxes through your tax return. This includes Social Security tax and other types of forms of tax that you may need to pay the state and the federal. With that said, you also may have retirement income, and with retirement income, you receive a 1099 SA for Social Security retirement, or if you have other type of retirement income, you're going to have forms that are filed with your taxes. The last thing we'll be looking at is actually your assets. Now, assets are reviewed based off of what type of asset you have. Historically, we want to see at least 2 months complete bank statements, all pages, for those assets that you'd like to use in a transaction. But real quickly, I'm going to spend a little time talking about this because I found it to be an issue for some people. If you have an income source that is not direct deposit, it's very important that we document the source of your deposits. So if you receive a paycheck, a live check, and you take it to the bank, you need to deposit the full value of that check. Meaning, just for round numbers, if you have a $1,000 paycheck net deposit, and you go to the bank and you make the deposit for $1,000, we can easily match up that paycheck stub with the deposit. However, if you go to the teller and the teller says, would you like any cash back? And you say you'd like $100 and you net deposit $900, then we're going to have a discrepancy. That kind of issue comes up more often than you think. And what happens is we then have to get an actual receipt copy of how that deposit broke down. Even though your gross deposit was $1,000, when you took $100 back, your net deposit was $900, and then our paperwork doesn't match up. So if you can at all possible do this, just deposit the full amount of the check. After that transaction is complete, then withdraw the difference out that you would like in cash. And then If you have direct deposit, much easier, we can track that. If you have other types of deposit, like Venmo or Zelle, we're gonna need to document the source of those deposits. I know that's a little bit more disruptive because sometimes these are just friends paying you back or something where you were reimbursed or something or you split a cost. But because these deposits are not direct deposit and they're not payroll, the bank is wanting to know where the source of funds are. Now, I can get into more detail in another podcast on why we look at assets, but it is important that you know that banks do monitor deposits. The second thing is if you have an asset that is within the range of retirement accounts or investment accounts, we're going to want to have the last 2 to 3 months of those because we want to see if you liquidate those accounts, if you're going to have any financial hardship by doing so. Sometimes when you sell off securities, you may incur a cost. And definitely, if you pull funds out of a retirement account, we are going to be looking at the potential tax consequences that you may have from what they have to withhold in order to do the distribution and whether or not you're old enough, because in the future you may have tax liability. So I strongly recommend that you talk with your tax professional about this. So when we get started in the application process itself, I kind of like to ask questions about where you see your overall personal budget and financial experience. How do you manage and view your financial obligations? Do you make them a priority to pay those who lend you money back on good faith? What are your patterns of paying back any other obligations? And I'm not talking about just credit. You might be looking at things that you pay monthly that are not showing on your credit report, like your utilities, your cell phone bill, perhaps your auto insurance. How has that pattern been? Has it been something that's been difficult? Has it been simple? Is it a part of your overall budget? Do you have a responsible mindset? These are all important factors that banks are looking at for financing, and they call this the character aspect of borrowing money. So I'm going to go into the three C's of underwriting. They are credit, capacity, and collateral. When we look at credit, we're looking at your past experiences with credit obligations. We want to know and determine if you're a good credit risk. Do you have established credit? And what I mean by established is at minimum 3 open and active accounts with 12 or greater months of positive payment history. No late payments on any accounts. This tells the bank that you're good with the smaller debts and you can fulfill those obligations because you're focused enough to repay those debts. Second is capacity. How much can you afford? What are your debt ratios? Debt ratios for most programs prefer 29 over 41. The 29 refers to 29% of your monthly income. When you add other debts, including your house payment plus any other debts that show on your credit, it could be a car payment, it could be perhaps a revolving credit card line with the minimum payments. When you add that plus your mortgage payment, we'd like to see that your total debt ratio not exceed 41% of your monthly income. The reason why that number is thrown out there is they have seen through statistical data that the success ratio of people maintaining homeownership is much higher if we stay within the lower debt to income ratios. And that allows for you to have more margin in case of any type of need that you have to spend money that you may have kept in reserves. This includes family emergencies, perhaps a need for fixing a vehicle, or any other financial obligations that come up. And we need to also leave money for utilities, cost of living, food, other items that you use for personal effects, life insurance, tithing if you do that for church, other expenses that you may have in your life. So we leave at least 59% of your income for that. So moving on, when we're looking at the last piece, we want to just break down within the capacity what your mortgage payment will include. Mortgage payments that are impounded, or meaning it includes taxes and insurance, will include these components. 1, the principal and interest on the loan. 2, the property taxes. 3, the homeowner's insurance. And 4, if it applies, mortgage insurance. If you're putting less than 20% down or you have a program that requires mortgage insurance, then that all together would equal the total payment. So again, principal and interest, property taxes, homeowner's insurance, and mortgage insurance, if it's applicable, will equal the total payment. So here's an example. Going with an FHA loan with $225,000 sales price at 5.5%, 30-year fixed, putting down 3.5% and financing your mortgage insurance premium upfront, your total principal and interest would be $1,254 a month. Using 1.25% for the property taxes, that'd be $234. And using 0.35% of the purchase price divided by 12, your homeowner's insurance about $63. And currently, with a 0.85% monthly mortgage insurance, your payment would be $152 for that. When you add these together, $1,254, $234, $63, and $152, your total monthly estimate payment will be $1,703. Now, this is a high number, especially if you're used to renting, but I want to go through a couple of things real quick with regards to how this is a benefit to you. So there's about a $200 difference when somebody compares a $1,500 monthly rent that they're paying to someone else versus $1,703, okay? When you look at that comparison, you may ask yourself, why would I buy if I could rent? It really has to do with the future. If you look at rents, on average, they raise themselves between 2 and 3% increase year over year. So when you're purchasing a house, your payment should remain very consistent because the principal and interest is locked. That'll never change. So in 5 years' time, the rent that was $1,500 will now be $1,713. And that's based off of a 3% annual rental rate increase. However, the same 5 years down the road, you will actually have the same payment of $1,703. So with that said, technically after 5 years, you'll have caught up with the amount that you've been paying, but in the same vein, you'd be growing as far as your equity in your property. If you push this out to a full 9 years, then you'll find that your rent would be actually $1,900. But let's look at the return. Your appreciation gain in the 9 year period would be $142,712 based off of purchasing a house at $225,000. That means that your house appreciation will have made your house 9 years down the road worth $367,712. Now, with that said, you're also paying the balance down on your mortgage because it is a mortgage. It has a balance that will go down as you make your monthly obligation. So that separation between the balance owed versus the value in the future will start spreading itself out. So you'll have gained an additional $33,000 in principal. So when you look at this, the overall net benefit to you for purchasing a property with that kind of setup is a net gain of almost $150,000. So purchasing a house can be a huge benefit. The third C within the three C's is the collateral. It's the house. This is what you're trying to attain. This is what the bank uses to hold up the value of their mortgage. The bank uses an appraisal and possibly other inspections to determine the value of what you're purchasing, and the house is what holds up our loan. So, no house, no collateral, no loan. So, with the things that we've discussed, I've gone through a lot of stuff in a short amount of time. I want to really encourage you, if you have questions, if it's very specific to a scenario, or you want to learn more about the different programs I discussed, including conventional loans and government-insured loans, please reach out to me or look for another podcast that has some data on those specific loan types, which I will be doing in order to create some value for you to be able to confidently go out and apply for a loan, get approved, and get your keys. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day. I appreciate your time, and God bless.